Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
This is Mary Robson for Nature Now at KPTZ. The second week in May, still reaching for rain gear and warm sweaters, and I hate to say this, but this morning I climbed into some long underwear. The plants are responding by growing green, green, and more green. The deciduous trees seem to be growing leaves on top of leaves. The conifers show tall candles, the nickname for furled new growth, ready to open. Today we'll hear again from Annika Wallendahl, who told listeners about the meteorite that landed near Port Townsend in 1895. Geology news today will be of materials both older and newer. And always the mystery sound. Here it comes. We're doing observations of what's happening around our natural area with help from Annika. The flowers at Katai Prairie Preserve, tucked behind the Port Townsend Golf Course. The acreage there, preserved, avoided development by benign neglect, as the Native Plant Society describes it. Spring blooms, especially blue camas, Camassia quamash, grow throughout the preserve, though the flowers are fading now. Camas, treasured as a food source by natives, shines at Katai. Years of weeding and care by the Washington Native Plant Society volunteers release the natives to growth. This acreage offers a small scrap of a large population of camas, once seen on both sides of the Cascades. Meriwether Lewis wrote in 1806 of seeing this striking lily in stands that, to his eyes, resembled lakes of blue water. The blooming season has arrived for the native madrona. Their branches are thickly covered now with white flowers, and these will produce fruits welcome to birds, and also welcome to early populations. Native Americans ate the fruits of the madrone uncooked. The wood is quite dense, making it difficult to work except by a very skillful carpenter. However, Mexican caballeros were known to make their spurs from this wood because of the hardness and the beautiful color. Very few trees have wood that is so hard it can duplicate the uses of metal.
Release of the coho fry report from Grant Street School. We just had 150 first and second graders from Grant Street Elementary School come out to Illahee Preserve. The kids brought the coho salmon fry they've been raising in their class. It was a joy to watch as they brought the tiny fish in cups one by one to Chimicum Creek. And everyone was delighted later when some kids found some of their newly released fry making themselves at home along the creek. Thanks to Jefferson Land Trust for this report. It's a beautiful example of the weaving of nature into our classroom activities. Seen around and about, Nan Evans reports, saw weird things from a hike with friends along the heart of the forest trail in the Olympic National Park. Lichens, maybe they always qualify as somewhat weird, frog's pelt, fairy barf. Frog pelt is easy to imagine, green and rather bumpy. Fairy barf is spotted with raised pink dots over a grayish background. I will add that after seeing fairy barf, I can't think of fairies as flitting dancers. Nan also reported seeing all seven of our local ferns. What a fine identification test. Her group heard a barred owl in the distance and gray jays near the Heart of the Hills campground.
Orcas. In terms of family structure, both resident and transients live in matriarchal societies with individual groups led by elder females. And many transient orcas have been observed recently in our area. For the most part, the resident orcas will stay with their moms for life. The young whales will often be found with their extended families, including aunts, uncles, cousins. I don't know how they know this, but and often their grandmothers and even great-grandmothers if they're still living. Traditionally, multiple matriarchal groups known as matrilines come together to form larger pods. Together, the residents hunt for schools of salmon by working together in these extended groups. The transients often travel in much smaller groups, perhaps because they hunt individual seals and sea lions, making the smaller groups more efficient. Younger females in transient groups generally stay with their mothers until they have calves of their own. Confusion comes in because an adult female with multiple calves may be seen swimming with her mother at times, but leading her own little group at other times. With various families doing different things and going different ways, transient groups are hard to define. During the month of April, about 20 different transient groups were positively identified in the Salish Sea, according to the Orca Network. For the month of April, 442 killer whale sightings were recorded, mostly of transients, although J-Pod was around for part of the month, according to data. In comparison, the sightings totaled 275 during April of last year, and going into May, the rate of sightings does not seem to be slowing down. The report on this comes from the Orca Network. And now we get to our always looked for interview today with Annika Wallendahl. And we are going to be talking about geomorphology, which is one of those wonderful 50-cent words, and talking about it in the context of how our area was shaped and then shows us something about its shape. Annika is a geologist, writer, I think terrific speaker, and very interested in exploring new areas in geology. So hi, Annika.
Hi.
Where do we go today here?
Geomorphology is the study of why landscapes look the way that they do, and we have many striking different landforms to choose from around here.
Uh-huh.
So I picked the top three.
Oh, good.
Top three geologic features or landforms to take a closer look at.
Are these the ones people would be more likely to identify?
They're larger, and it's an arbitrary top three, but they're easy to find.
I think it's your top three, so there you go.
Okay.
Okay, so how do they stand?
Well, we have the best spit, which is Dungeness spit and squim.
Best relative to whom? It's pretty terrific.
Yeah, it's the longest sand spit in the United States. It's 5.5 miles long.
Okay.
And it's been a refuge since 1915, and it's part of a 756-acre preserve now.
I'm still surprised at it being a refuge for birds and other animals since 1915.
Yeah, from what
How did that happen?
From what I understand, it was put in as a preserve to protect a wintering place for the black brant and other bird species.
Wow. So there it is.
And it's constantly moving. Spits are dynamic and unstable. The material moves and the spit can move and change dramatically or slowly over time. Mm-hmm. And typically spits form near an eroding bluff, which is the source of its sediment.
Aha. And so can we see that eroding bluff from, say, we walk down to the spit, which is, you know, up, we're going downhill. Is the eroding bluff visible, or do you know? I don't know. I've never thought about it being part of the spit.
Well, sand and material coming from the bluffs on both sides.
Okay.
And there's actually, on both sides of Dungeness spit, there's erosion going on. The Strait of Juan de Fuca is, of course, the bluffs facing the strait are under constant pummeling from the waves. And which way sediment transports has to do from the foot of a bluff, which way it goes has to do with currents and winds, but that's the source of the spit.
When you visit it, you tend to have the feeling that it's just as if as it's always been, which it isn't from even one month to the next, right?
No, there was a storm, and I don't remember what year it was, but it did actually breach the spit in three places.
Oof.
So, and then over time, it healed itself and sand filled in again.
It's a very interesting and quite beautiful area. Are there any other notable spits around and about here that we might think about?
Well, Point Wilson at Fort Worden has a very nice spit where the lighthouse is.
Uh-huh.
And then the lighthouse at Fort Flagler State Park.
Okay.
That one's actually really striking as well.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing about spits, I have to say, is they're very comfortable to walk on because of the, because of the materials. Okay, so we have the geomorphology is identifying the way the material is distributed and the size and shape of the geologic formation, right?
Yeah, so the Earth's surface is constantly being reworked by gravity, by wind, by animals that burrow, by rivers and streams, glaciers, volcanoes, and all of that. And gravity works to reshape the land and create geomorphic features.
The humans are so literal, we tend to think that because we saw it today, it's going to be the same tomorrow. And maybe that's one of the greatest things about geology.
Yeah.
I don't know. So what's your next feature here?
Well, there's a best picnic spot, and it's a pocket beach that's located in Port Hadlock between, actually underneath the Portage Bridge.
The big bridge.
Yeah, the big bridge, Port Hadlock to Indian Island, and it's Highway 116 that runs over there. And some people call that the Port Townsend Ship Canal or just Portage Canal. And at the base of the footings on the Indian Island side, there are some marvelous pocket beaches tucked in between sandstones and basalt.
Nice.
Yeah.
So you say the best beach picnic area. First pack the picnic, then get yourself over to Indian Island and turn right onto that area. It's the only really accessible part of Indian Island for most of us who are civilians.
You park at Indian Island County Park, and then you walk down a trail, and then take a right and hike underneath the bridge. You should go at low tide. Your access is better then. Also, there's great clamming for butter clams under there as well,
when
they're in season.
Yeah. Good. And they're in season and you have the equipment. Right. So that's known as digging for dinner, yes?
Yeah. And then, so these pocket beaches are just, you know, some of them are only 10 or 20 feet wide and they're just eroded into the bedrock. So when you go and you sit down there, you really can't see much to the left or right. But then when, you know, people go by in their boats, you can wave at them and see them. So you really feel secluded and like you're really far out
there.
That's
a nice part of a picnic, too, is waving at people. So in other words, when you sit down, your back is to, is it the pre-glacial? You said bedrock. It's pre-glacial out there?
Yeah, there's sandstones and basalts that are, I believe, more than 50 million years old, so quite old.
That's the old part of today. Wow, okay.
Yeah.
You can identify them, particularly the basalts, right, by their color and texture?
There's a notable basalt intrusion, really just on the north side of the bridge footings.
Okay.
And the basalt erupted after the sandstone was in place, so it created a baked zone on both sides of where it pushed its way through. So that baked part of the sandstone is more resistant, so it sticks out farther towards the water, and then the basalt has been eroding at a faster rate than the sandstone, so it's more recessed.
It's the first time I ever heard the term baked sandstone, but we'll do it. It's a really comfortable place to go and place to take your eyeballs and learn a little bit more about geology there. So you said that's your second best, and I assume you have picnicked there because you seem quite comfortable with that.
Yeah, especially like on a sunny day, there's a breezy there, and it's just a nice...
That's nice. And there is lots to watch. Okay, so there we have two. We have a spit, and we have some pocket beaches. Both of those involve sand. Is there sand involved in your last choice about major geomorphology features around here?
No, actually. So for the notable best tide pools and blowholes location,
okay,
that's going to be Salt Creek County Park, which is west of Port Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit of a drive here from Port Townsend, but just incredibly scenic, and that forms Tongue Point, which is just rich with marine life, and it's a marine sanctuary, and lots of schools take trips out there to investigate the anemones.
I have been there, but I did not identify Tongue Point. So is it called Tongue Point because of the shape of the land at that?
I think that's why it's called that.
Okay. We can't always tell from common things and how they're described.
Yeah, and Tongue Point separates Crescent Bay from the Strait of Juan de Fuca.
And Crescent Bay is to your right as you are at Salt Creek, is that correct?
No, Crescent Bay is a little more to the west.
Oh, okay, so I have it completely backwards. Don't listen to me, listen to Annika. Okay, so what else would you like to add about that particular area?
Well, besides the tide pools, there is some excellent blowholes that you can see when the tide's coming
in. So describe that. It's the water forcing itself through a rock, right?
Yeah, so a blowhole is a sea cave, and the cave grows landwards, and then the cave will grow upwards. So it connects the ocean with a vertical shaft through the bedrock. So it pressurizes water that the tide comes in, and then it fills in the blowhole, and then it'll shoot out the top through a crevice or a crack.
So this depends on the state of the tide?
Yeah.
Okay.
So high tide would be the best time to view the blowholes, and as the water surges in and out with mm-hmm. the tide, you'll have water spouting out the top, which looks like a whale's blowhole, which is, okay.
I kind of thought it might have got its name from that, but do you have any perception of how far up the water goes? I mean, is it like a 8 feet, or in seeing it, how does it relate to the size of the rock?
Yeah, so the ones I saw reach several feet in the air. So, okay. I mean, you're not going to get the 20-foot ones like you might find.
This is not Yellowstone, right?
Right. Well, that'd be a geyser, too.
That would be nice.
Hawaii, I haven't seen them, but I think on Maui, there's some exceptional blowholes that are 20 feet or higher.
Yes. Okay, listeners, send us a note to the website at KPTZ if you have seen very high blowholes in Hawaii. It is also, talking of transients, as we were talking about transient orca populations, these blowholes must be transient too in a slow way as the feature wears.
Yeah, I mean, eventually it'll weather and wear, so it's just not a cave so much anymore mm-hmm. as the rock crumbles.
You have to have a place underneath where the water comes in and goes up like a channel?
Yeah,
so I'm trying to visualize this, and I...
Yeah, so places where blowholes are likely to form are in basalts where you had lava tubes.
Okay.
So you already had an empty kind of horizontal channel that started the sea cave, and
okay.
then the pounding as the water comes in and out. Mm-hmm. Also fractured basalt where water will preferentially erode along the fractures.
Okay.
And so these are basalts of the Crescent Formation that are exposed here at Salt Creek County Park.
Okay.
And so you can also find pillow basalts and all kinds of great structures.
And basalt is the product of heat, right? This is coming from fairly far underground where you have a very large hot population of rocks.
Yeah, these are volcanic basalts that erupted at the seafloor.
Have I remembered something wrong, that the Olympic Mountains are partly volcanic but not completely?
So they're the product of subduction. So there's a plate that mm-hmm. is subducting or being pushed underneath the North American plate.
Mm-hmm.
And getting scraped off along the way are the ocean basalts and then the ocean sediments that had formed and settled on top of them.
I think there's been a lot of attention to plates after a flight of small earthquakes in the last week. Just a bunch of, as if, hey, it's active out here. Something is happening.
I felt one in Port Ludlow.
We didn't start out to discuss earthquakes, but they may be releasing tension, or do we know?
I'm still waiting to see what the there's the Pacific Seismic Network and University of Washington Seismology Lab. So I'm still waiting to see what they're saying about the recent small earthquakes.
Right.
They've all been magnitude 3.3,
right.
3.4, smaller, around Bremerton and Hansville.
So. Sure. Not enough to knock a cup off the shelf, actually, but you can feel them, that's for sure. I wanted to ask one more thing about the earthquakes before we get any farther. When I read about that little flight in Hansville and such, it said that they were very, very deep. rather than being at the same level as the Cascadia Fault or the Seattle Fault. I don't know, but that they were deep earthquakes. So we don't know. And we have seismic equipment that will pick up something very small, yes?
Yeah.
Okay.
Extremely sensitive.
Right. So they're actually probably picking up something that looks like we have earthquakes every day, which we don't notice, but there's a lot moving, right?
Yeah, there's a lot going on down there, and we don't necessarily, as surface dwellers, don't necessarily feel it all.
Well, some of us can, perhaps geologists, dwell below the surface mentally anyway, because you're thinking, what's going on here anyway? I'm sorry to say we have to wind up here, and what this means is that, listeners, we will have Annika back on another topic, perhaps in a couple of months, because this is so fascinating. We really, really enjoy it. And thank you so much for being here and doing this and bringing us your insight. Now, everybody can define geomorphology.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks for having me.
You are so welcome. Well, now having had Annika take us deep and high, we will go to our mystery sound, the gray jay. Highly curious and always on the lookout for food, gray jays eat just about anything from berries to small animals. I have seen one snatch a half a sandwich from a hiker who was gesturing by waving it. This was a very funny event. The gray jay stores large quantities of food in summer for later use. It glues the small food items to tree branches above the height of the eventual snow line. How does it know that? We don't know. They store food by producing special saliva from large glands and molding the food into a sticky blob, gluing it behind flakes of bark, under lichen, in conifer needles, or in tree forks. They seem to have a good success rate of remembering where they have stored food. They stay with their mates as long as both birds are alive, and the members of a territorial pair rarely leave each other's sides. The pair breeds in February during the coldest part of winter and has their clutch of eggs and their nestlings earlier than most birds. In 2016, the gray jay was named Canada's national bird after tens of thousands of votes were cast online, ruffling the feathers of some ornithologists. Its range covers most of Canada. In the United States, the gray jay is confined to small ranges in the arboreal Pacific Northwest and some areas of the Rocky Mountains. There are also reports of sightings from northern New England, which must have just flown over from Canada. They tend to be fearless of humans, particularly when human food is involved. And people vary in their opinions of gray jays, from cute and friendly to, yikes, what a pest. Okay. Upcoming events. The Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society at Dungeness at the Railroad Bridge has a presentation Wednesday, May 17th, called Birds, Wise and Wondrous, Mischievous and Mystical. This is a storyteller telling about birds. It starts at 7 o'clock and will probably be quite fascinating. And our last event is a field trip to the Dungeness Recreation Area, May 20th, 8:30 a.m. to 12 p.m. That is free. And heavens, so that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news of the natural community where we live. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays with repeats here on KPTZ 91.9 on Thursdays at 5 p.m. and Saturdays at 11:30 a.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the website www.kptz.org.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Sonny Flores. Closing music is by the Guess Who, Share the Land. Together now.
this morning when the paper landed in your yard. Do you know their names? Can you play their games without losing track and coming down a bit too hard?